After the last client left and Sybil said goodbye and locked the front door, father and son relaxed in the big office and talked about college basketball and hockey. Then family, the twin sisters first, as always, then Patty.
"Does your mother know you're in town?"
John asked.
"No, I'll call her tomorrow."
"She's okay?"
"Nothing's changed. She's fine."
Patty lived and worked in the loft of an old warehouse in York. It was a large space with lots of windows that provided the light she needed to pursue her painting. John paid the rent, utilities, and everything else she needed through a monthly stipend of $3,000. It wasn't alimony, and it certainly wasn't child support, but simply a gift he felt compelled to pass along for her upkeep because she could not support herself. If she had sold a painting or a sculpture in the past 19 years, no one in the family knew about it.
"I call her every Tuesday night," Kyle said.
"I know you do."
Patty had no use for computers or cell phones. She was severely bipolar, and the mood swings were, at times, astonishing. John still loved her and had never remarried, though he'd enjoyed a few girlfriends. Patty had been through at least two ruinous affairs, both with fellow artists, much younger men, and John had been there to pick up the pieces. Their relationship was complicated, to say the least.
"So how's school?" John asked.
"Downhill. I graduate in 3 months."
"That's hard to believe."
Kyle swallowed hard and decided to get it over with.
"I've changed my mind about employment. I'm going to Wall Street, Scully and Pershing."
John slowly lit another cigarette. He was 62, thick but not fat, with a head full of wavy gray hair that began no more than 3 inches above his eyebrows. Kyle, at 25, had lost more hair than his father. John took a long drag from his Winston and studied his son from behind wire-rimmed reading glasses perched on his nose.
"Any particular reason?"
The list of reasons had been memorized, but Kyle knew they would sound flat, regardless of how smoothly they were delivered. "The legal services gig is a waste of time. I'll end up on Wall Street eventually, so why not get the career started?"
"I don't believe this."
I know, it's an about-face."
"It's a sellout. There's nothing that requires you to pursue a career in a corporate firm."
"It's the big leagues, Dad."
"In terms of what? Money?"
"That's a start."
"No way. There are trial lawyers who make 10 times more each year than the biggest partners in New York."
"Yes, and for every big trial lawyer, there are 5,000 starving sole practitioners. On the average, the money is much better in a big firm."
"You'll hate every minute of a big firm."
"Maybe not."
"Of course you will. You grew up here, around people and real clients. You won't see a client for 10 years in New York."
"It's a nice firm, Dad. One of the best."
John yanked a pen from his pocket.
"Let me write this down, so a year from now I can read it back to you."
"Go ahead."
"I said, it's a nice firm. One of the best."
John took notes and said,
"You're going to hate this firm and its lawyers and cases, and you'll probably even hate the secretaries and the other rookie associates. You're going to hate the grind, the routine, the sheer drudgery of all the mindless crap they dump on you. Response?"
"I disagree."
"Great," John said, still writing.
Then he pulled on the cigarette and blew out an impressive cloud of smoke. He put down the pen.
"I thought you wanted to try something different and help people in the process. Did I not hear these words from you just a few weeks ago?"
"I've changed my mind."
"Well, change it back. It's not too late."
"No."
"But why? There must be a reason."
"I just don't want to spend 3 years in rural Virginia trying to learn enough Spanish so I can listen to the problems of people who are here illegally in the first place."
"I'm sorry, but that sounds like a great way to spend the next 3 years." "I don't buy it. Give me another reason."
With that, John shoved his leather swivel chair back and jumped to his feet. Kyle had seen this a million times. His father preferred to pace and toss his hands about when he was agitated and firing questions. It was an old habit from the courtroom, and it was not unexpected.
"I'd like to make some money."
"For what? To buy things? Some new toys? You won't have the time to play with them."
"I plan to save..."
"Of course you will. Living in Manhattan is so cheap, you'll save a fortune."
He was walking in front of his ego wall, framed certificates and photos almost to the ceiling.
"I don't buy it.
and I don't like it."
His cheeks were turning colors. The Scottish temper was warming up.
"Speak softly," Kyle reminded himself. A sharp word or two would make things much worse. He would survive this little clash, as he had survived the others, and one day soon all the harsh words would be over and Kyle would be off to New York.
"It's all about the money, isn't it, Kyle?" John said. "You were raised better."
"I'm not here to be insulted, Dad. I've made my decision. I ask you to respect it. A lot of fathers would be thrilled with such a job."
John McAvoy stopped pacing and stopped smoking, and he looked across his office at the handsome face of his only son, a 25-year-old who was quite mature and unbelievably bright, and he decided to back off.
The decision was made. He'd said enough. Any more and he might say too much.
"Okay," he said. "Okay. It's all you. You're smart enough to know what you want. But I'm your father, and I'll have some opinions about your next big decision, and the next. That's what I'm here for. If you screw up again, I'll damn sure let you know it."
"I'm not screwing up, Dad."
"I will not bicker.
Can we go to dinner? I'm starving."
"I need a drink."
They rode together to Victor's Italian restaurant, John's Friday night ritual for as long as Kyle could remember. John had his usual end-of-the-week martini. Kyle had his standard drink, club soda with a twist of lime. They ordered pasta with meatballs, and after the second martini, John began to mellow. Having his son at the largest and most prestigious law firm in the country did have a nice ring to it. But he was still puzzled by the abrupt change in plans.
"If you only knew," Kyle kept saying to himself. And he ached because he couldn't tell his father the truth.
Chapter 9. Kyle was relieved when his mother did not answer the phone. He waited until almost 11 on Saturday morning before calling. He left a pleasant little message about popping in for a quick hello as he was passing through York for some vague reason. She was either asleep or medicated, or if it was a good day, she was in her studio thoroughly absorbed in creating some of the most dreadful art never seen in a gallery or an exhibition. Visits with his mother were painful. She rarely left her loft for any reason, so the suggestion that they meet for coffee or lunch was always dismissed. If the meds were in sync, she talked incessantly while forcing Kyle to admire her latest masterpieces. If the meds were out of order, she would lie on the sofa with her eyes closed, unbathed, unkempt, often inconsolable in her gloom and misery. She seldom asked about his life, college, law school, girlfriends, plans for the future. She was much too absorbed in her own sad little world. Kyle's twin sisters stayed far away from York. He left the message on her recorder as he was hustling out of town and hoped she didn't return the call anytime soon. She did not. In fact, the call was never returned, which was not unusual. 4 hours later, he was in Pittsburgh. Joey Bernardo had tickets for the Penguins Senators hockey game Saturday night. 3 tickets, not 2. They met at Boomerang's, a favorite watering hole from their college days. After Kyle quit drinking, Joey did not, he avoided most bars. Driving to Pittsburgh, he had hoped for some quiet time with his old roommate, but it wasn't to be. The 3rd ticket was for Blair, Joey's soon-to-be-announced fiancé. By the time the 3 of them settled into a tight booth and ordered drinks, Joey was gushing with the news that they had just become engaged and were looking at wedding dates. Both were glowing with love and romance and seemed oblivious to everything else. They held hands, sat close, even giggled at each other. And after 5 minutes, Kyle felt uncomfortable. What had happened to his friend? Where was the old Joey? The tough kid from South Pittsburgh, son of a fire captain, accomplished boxer, all-conference high school fullback, tremendous appetite for girls, a cynical, smart-ass wisecracker who believed women were disposable, the guy who'd vowed he wouldn't marry until he was at least 40. Blair had turned him to mush. Kyle was astonished at the transformation. They eventually tired of their wedding plans and potential honeymoon destinations, and the talk turned to careers. Blair, a chatterbox who began every sentence with either I or me or my, worked for an advertising agency and spent far too much time detailing some of their latest marketing maneuvers. Joey hung on every word,
while Kyle began glancing at the clock behind them, high above a row of windows. As she prattled on, Kyle worked hard at maintaining enough eye contact to feign interest, but his mind drifted to the video.
"Is she awake?" Joey asks as Baxter has sex with a dangerously intoxicated Elaine Keenan.
"Blair travels to Montreal quite often," Joey said. Then Blair ricocheted onto the subject of Montreal and its beauty. "She was learning French."
"Is she awake?"
Joey, sitting there with his hand under the table, no doubt rubbing some flesh, had no earthly idea that such a video existed. When was the last time Joey even thought about the incident? Ever? Had he forgotten it completely? And what good would it do for Kyle to bring it up now? After the Pittsburgh police quietly closed the file on Elaine and her rape, the brothers of Beta buried it too. During his last 2 years of college, Kyle could not remember a single instance when the episode was discussed. Elaine disappeared and was quickly forgotten. If Benny Wright and his operatives had been snooping around Duquesne and Pittsburgh in recent weeks, Kyle wanted to know about it. Perhaps Joey might have seen or heard something. Perhaps not. Joey wasn't noticing much these days, except for Blair.
"Have you talked to Baxter?" Joey asked when Blair finally stopped for air.
"Not in a month or so." Joey was grinning as if a joke was on the way.
"He finally got in a movie, you know."
"No kidding. He didn't tell me." Blair giggled like a first grader because she undoubtedly knew the rest of the story.
"That's because he doesn't want you to know," Joey went on.
"Must be a great movie."
"Yeah, he got drunk one night, and by the way, the drinking is now in no man's land. So he called and told me he'd made his debut. It was a cheap cable flick about a young girl who finds a human leg washed up on a beach, and for the rest of the movie she has nightmares about being chased by a one-legged killer."
"Where does the great Baxter Tate fit in?"
"Well, you have to watch real close or you'll miss him. There's a scene on a boat where the cops are gazing at the ocean, presumably looking for the rest of the body, though this is never clear. The movie has a lot of uncertainties. One of the deputies walks over to the sheriff and says, 'Sir, we're low on fuel.' That's our movie star."
"Baxter is a deputy?"
"And a bad one. He has only that one line and delivers it like a frightened sophomore in the school play."
"Was he sober?"
"Who knows, but I would say yes. If he'd been drunk, as usual, he would have nailed the line."
"I can't wait to see it."
"Don't, and don't tell him I mentioned it. He called the next morning, begging me not to watch it and threatening me if I told anyone. He's a mess."
And that reminded Blair of one of her friends who knew someone out there who landed a role in a new sitcom, and away she went. Kyle smiled and nodded as his brain switched compartments. Of the three roommates, Joey was the only one who could possibly help, if indeed help was possible. Baxter Tate was in dire need of intensive rehab. Alan Strock was thoroughly consumed with medical school at Ohio State, and of the four, was clearly the least likely to get involved. For Joey, the stakes were high. He was on the tape, wondering aloud if Elaine was awake and conscious while Baxter did the deed. Then Joey himself took a turn. He was currently handling accounts at a regional brokerage firm in Pittsburgh and had two promotions under his belt. He was goofy in love with Air Blair here, and any hint of an old rape charge would upset their perfect lives. On the one hand, Kyle felt as though he was taking the fall for Joey. He hadn't touched Elaine that night, yet it was his life and career now getting hijacked by Benny Wright and his dirty little video. Shouldn't Joey at least know about it? And on the other hand, Kyle couldn't convince himself that he should drop the bomb on Joey at this point. If he, Kyle, took the Scully and Pershing job and met the demands of Benny Wright and didn't get caught, there was a decent chance the video would eventually be forgotten. Hours later, during a break in the game, with Blair off in the ladies' room, Kyle suggested they meet Sunday for breakfast. He needed to leave town early, he said. And might it be possible to get together without Blair for an hour or so? Let her sleep in, maybe? They met for bagels at a shop owned by a chain, a place that had not existed when Kyle was at Duquesne. Blair was still asleep somewhere, and Joey admitted to needing a break.
"Sweet girl," Kyle said more than once, and each time felt guilty for lying.
He could not imagine a life with such a windbag. She had great legs, though, the type Joey had always coveted. They talked about New York for a long time. Life in a big firm, the grind of the city, the sports teams, other friends who were there, and so on. Kyle eventually brought the conversation around to the old Beta gang, and they played catch-up for a while. They laughed at pranks and hazing and parties and stupid stunts pulled by themselves and others. They were 25 now, far removed from the craziness of their early college days, and the nostalgia was fun for a few minutes. Several times, the Elaine thing was at the surface, waiting for a comment or a question. But Joey did not mention it. It was forgotten. When they said goodbye, Kyle was convinced that Joey had buried the episode forever, and more important, no one had brought it to his attention recently. He drove north to Interstate 80, then headed east. New York was not far away, neither in time nor in distance. A few more weeks in the cozy world of academia, then 2 months prepping for the bar exam, and in early September he would report for duty at the largest law firm in the world. There would be 100 associates in his class, all bright kids from the finest schools, all polished and decked out in their newest clothes, all anxious to jumpstart their brilliant legal careers. Kyle felt lonelier each day. But he wasn't exactly isolated, not even close. His movements to, in, and around York and Pittsburgh were closely monitored by Benny Wright and his gang. A small magnetic transmitter, the size of a man's wallet, was tucked away under some mud and dirt in the rear bumper of Kyle's red Cherokee. It was hot-wired from the left taillight and emitted a constant GPS signal that kept track of the vehicle anywhere it went. From his office in Lower Manhattan, Benny knew precisely where the Jeep was located. He was not surprised by Kyle's visit home, but the trip to see Joey Bernardo was far more interesting. Benny had no shortage of gadgets, some high-tech, some low-tech, and all very effective, because he tracked simple civilians and not real spies. Corporate espionage was far easier than that of the military or national security variety. Kyle's cell phone had long since been compromised, and they listened to every conversation. The kid had yet to mention his predicament to anyone on the phone. They were also listening to Olivia's chatter, as well as that of Mitch, his roommate. So far, nothing. They were reading Kyle's emails. He averaged 27 a day, and almost all were law school related. Other efforts to listen were far more difficult. An agent had eaten at Victor's in York at a table 20 feet from Kyle and his father, but heard almost nothing. Another had managed to land a seat 2 rows away at the Penguins game, but it was a wasted effort. At Boomerang's, though, one of Benny's stars, a 26-year-old blonde in tight jeans, managed to secure the booth next to Kyle, Joey, and Blair. She sipped one beer for 2 hours, read a paperback, and reported that the girl talked nonstop and about nothing. Benny was generally pleased with the progress. Kyle had abruptly declined the legal services job in Virginia. He had hustled over to New York and cleared things with Scully and Pershing. He was seeing less of Olivia, and it was obvious, at least to Benny, that the relationship was going nowhere. But the sudden trip to Pittsburgh was bothersome. Had he planned to confide in Joey? Had he, in fact, done so? Was Alan Strock next? Would Kyle attempt to contact him and/or Baxter Tate? Benny was listening in all the right places, and waiting. He had leased 2,000 square feet of office space in a building across Broad Street and 2 blocks down from Scully and Pershing. The tenant's name was Fancher Group, a financial services startup domiciled in Bermuda. Its registered agent in New York was Aaron Kurtz, also known as Benny Wright, also known as a dozen other men, with perfect identification to prove any alias he chose. From his new perch, Benny could glance out his window and gaze down Broad Street, and in a few short months, he'd be able to actually see their boy Kyle enter and leave his place of employment. Chapter 10. The lawsuit was filed in federal court in the Southern District of New York, Manhattan Division, at 5:10 on a Friday afternoon, a time chosen so that the filing would attract as little attention as possible from the press. A late Friday dump.
The lawyer who signed it was a noted litigator named Wilson Rush, a senior partner with Scully and Pershing, and throughout the day he had telephoned the clerk to make sure it would be properly received and docketed before the court closed for the week. Like all cases, it was filed electronically. No one from the firm was required to walk into the Daniel Patrick Moynihan U.S. Courthouse on Pearl Street and hand over a thick pile of papers to commence the action. Of the 40 or so civil lawsuits filed that day in the Southern District, it was by far the most serious, most complex, and most anticipated. The parties involved had been feuding for years, and while much of their bickering had been well reported, most of the issues were too sensitive to bear in public. The Pentagon, many senior members of Congress, and even the White House had worked diligently to prevent litigation, but all efforts had failed. The next battle in the war had begun, and no one expected a quick resolution. The parties and their lawyers would fight with bare knuckles for years as the dispute crept its way through the federal judiciary and eventually landed at the Supreme Court for a final ruling. The clerk, upon receiving the complaint, quickly rerouted it to a secure bin to prevent its contents from being exposed. This procedure was extremely rare and had been ordered by the chief district judge. A bare-bones summary of the lawsuit was ready and available to the press. It had been prepared under the direction of Mr. Rush, and it, too, had been approved by the judge. The plaintiff was Trilon Aeronautics, a well-known defense contractor based in New York, a privately held company that had been designing and building military aircraft for 4 decades. The defendant was Barton Dynamics, a publicly held defense contractor based in Bethesda, Maryland. Barton averaged about $15 billion a year in government contracts, a sum that represented 95% of its annual revenue. Barton used different lawyers for its different needs, but for the biggest fights, it was protected by the Wall Street firm of A.G. Poe and Epps. Scully and Pershing currently had 2,100 lawyers and claimed to be the largest firm in the world. A.G. Poe and Epps had 200 fewer lawyers but boasted of more offices around the world. Thus, it claimed to be the largest. Each firm spent far too much time jockeying with the other and boasting of its size, power, prestige, billings, partner profiles, and anything else that might jack up its rankings. The core of the dispute was the latest Pentagon boondoggle to build the B-10 hypersonic bomber, a space-age aircraft that had been dreamed about for decades and was now closer to becoming a reality. 5 years earlier, the Air Force had launched a contest among its top contractors to design the B-10, a sleek bomber that would replace the aging fleet of B-52s and B-22s and serve the military through the year 2060. Lockheed, the largest defense contractor, was the expected front-runner in the competition, but it was quickly outpaced by a joint venture put together by Trilon and Barton. A consortium of foreign companies, British, French, and Israeli, had smaller roles in the joint venture. The prize was enormous. The Air Force would pay the winner $10 billion up front to develop the advanced technologies and build a prototype, and then contract for the procurement of 250 to 450 B-10s over the next 30 years. At an estimated $800 billion, the contract would be the richest in the Pentagon's history. The anticipated cost overruns were beyond calculation. The Trilon-Barton design was astounding. Their B-10 could take off from a base in the United States with a payload the same size as a B-52, fly at 7,600 miles per hour, or Mach 10, and deliver its payload on the other side of the world in an hour, at a speed and from an altitude that would defy all current and foreseen defensive measures. After delivery of whatever it happened to be hauling, the B-10 could return to its home base without refueling, either in flight or on the ground. The aircraft would literally skip along the edge of the atmosphere. After ascending to an altitude of 130,000 feet, just outside the stratosphere, the B-10 would turn off its engines and float back to the surface of the atmosphere. Once there, its air-breathing engines would kick on and lift the plane back to 130,000 feet. This procedure, a skipping motion much like that of a flat rock bouncing across still water, would be repeated until the aircraft arrived at its target. A bombing run that originated in Arizona and ended in Asia would require about 30 skips, with the B-10 popping through the atmosphere once every 90 seconds. B-10
Because the engines would be used intermittently, significantly smaller amounts of fuel would be required. And by leaving the atmosphere and venturing into cold space, the heat buildup would be dissipated. After 3 years of intense and often frantic research and design, the Air Force announced that it had selected the Trilon-Barton design. This was done with as little fanfare as possible, since the dollar amounts were staggering, the country was fighting two wars, and the Pentagon decided it would not be wise to broadcast such an ambitious procurement plan. The Air Force tried its best to downplay the B-10 program, but it was a waste of time. As soon as the winner was announced, fighting erupted on all fronts. Lockheed roared back with its senators and lobbyists and lawyers. Trilon and Barton, historically fierce competitors, began sniping almost immediately. The prospect of that much money splintered any notion of cooperation. Each corralled its politicians and lobbyists and joined the fight for a bigger piece of the pork. The British, French, and Israelis eased to the sidelines, but certainly did not go away. Both Trilon and Barton claimed ownership of the design and the technologies. Efforts to mediate succeeded, then failed. Lockheed loomed in the background, waiting. The Pentagon threatened to yank the contract and have another contest. Congressmen held hearings. Governors wanted jobs and economic development. Journalists wrote long pieces in magazines. Waste and watchdog groups railed against the B-10 as if it were a shuttle to Mars. And the lawyers quietly prepared for litigation. 2 hours after the lawsuit was filed, Kyle saw it posted on the federal court's website. He was at his desk in his office at the Yale Law Journal, editing a lengthy article on his computer. For 3 weeks now, he had been checking the filings in all the federal courts in New York, as well as the state courts. During their first wretched session, Benny had mentioned the upcoming filing of a massive lawsuit in New York, the one that Kyle was now expected to infiltrate. In meetings since then, Kyle had repeatedly prodded Benny for information about the lawsuit, but each inquiry had been met with a dismissive, "We'll talk about it later." Oddly, the online posting of the lawsuit revealed nothing but its title and the name, address, law firm, and bar certification number of Wilson Rush. The word "secure" was inserted after the title, and Kyle was unable to access the contents of the complaint. In the Southern District of New York, no other case filed in the past 3 weeks had been locked away in such a manner. Red flags began to wave. He searched A.G. Poe and Epps and studied their exhaustive list of corporate clients. The firm had represented Barton Dynamics since the 1980s. Kyle forgot about the law journal work piled on his desk and around his chair and lost himself on the internet. A search of Trilon soon revealed its B-10 hypersonic bomber project and all the problems it had caused, and, evidently, was still creating. Kyle closed the door of his small office and checked the printer for paper. It was almost 8 on Friday night, and though the law journal types were known for their odd hours, the crew had cleared out. He printed all available corporate info on Trilon and Barton, then added more paper. There were several dozen newspaper and magazine articles on the B-10 fiasco. He printed them all and began reading the most serious ones. He found 100 defense and military websites, and on one for futuristic warfare, there were pages of background on the B-10. He checked prior court filings to see how often Scully and Pershing had sued on behalf of or defended Trilon, and did the same for A.G. Poe and Epps and Barton. On into the night he dug and dug, and the thicker his file became, the worse he felt. There was a chance he was chasing the wrong lawsuit. He couldn't know for sure until Benny confirmed it, but there was little doubt. The timing was on schedule. The law firms were in place. Billions were at stake, just as Benny had said. Two corporations that were old competitors. Two law firms that hated each other. Military secrets. Stolen technology. Corporate espionage. Foreign intelligence. Threats of litigation and even criminal prosecution. It was one monumental, sordid mess. And now he, Kyle McAvoy, was expected to insert himself into the fray. In recent weeks, he had often speculated about what type of case was worth the high cost of such elaborate espionage. Two corporate rivals fighting over a pot of gold could describe any number of disputes. Perhaps it was an antitrust case, or a patent dispute, or a couple of drug companies brawling over the latest obesity pill. The worst-case scenario was the one he had just been handed. A gold-plated Pentagon procurement program complete with secret technologies, warring politicians, ruthless executives, and so on. The list was long and disheartening. Why couldn't he just go back to York and practice law with his father? At 1 a.m., he stuffed his notebooks into his backpack and for a few seconds went through the fruitless ritual of straightening his desk. He looked around, turned off the light, locked his door, and again realized that any decent operative could intrude whenever he wanted. He felt certain Benny and his thugs had been there, probably with bugs and wires and mics and other crap that Kyle tried not to think about. And he was sure they were watching. In spite of his demands that Benny leave him alone, Kyle knew they were following him. He'd seen them several times. They were good, but they had made a few mistakes. The challenge, he told himself repeatedly, was to act as though he had no clue that they were watching. Just play the role of a naive, unconcerned college kid hauling a backpack around campus and looking at girls. He never changed his routines, or his routes, or parking lots. Same spot for lunch almost every day. Same coffee shop where he met Olivia occasionally after class. He was either at the law school or at his apartment, with few diversions along the way. And because his habits remained the same, so did those of his shadows. They became lazy because he was such an easy target. Kyle, the innocent, lulled them to sleep. And when they nodded off, he caught them. One face he'd seen three times already. A young, ruddy face with different eyeglasses and a mustache that came and went. At a used bookstore near the campus, Kyle began buying old paperback spy novels for a dollar each. He bought them one at a time, kept the current one in his backpack, and when he finished, he tossed it in the wastebasket at the law school and bought another. He assumed that none of his communications were confidential. His cell phone and laptop were compromised, he was certain. He increased, slightly, his emails to Joey Bernardo, Alan Strock, and Baxter Tate, but all messages were quick howdies with almost no substance. He did the same for other Beta brothers, all under the guise of encouraging his buddies to do a better job of keeping in touch. He called each of them once a week and talked sports and school and careers. If Benny was in fact listening, he heard not one word to indicate Kyle was even remotely suspicious. Kyle convinced himself that to survive the next 7 years, he must learn to think and act like his adversaries. There was a way out, somewhere. Benny was back in town. They met for a sandwich on Sunday at a pita place north of town, away from campus. He had promised to drop in every other week or so throughout the spring, until Kyle graduated in May. Kyle had asked why this was necessary. Benny had offered some meaningless blather about maintaining contact. In each of their subsequent meetings, Benny's personality had softened slightly. He would always be the no-nonsense, hard-ass handler with a mission, but he was acting as though he wanted their time together to be somewhat pleasant. After all, they would spend hours together, he said, and this always evoked a frown from Kyle, who wanted no part of any pleasant chit-chat. "Any plans for spring break?" Benny asked as they unwrapped their sandwiches. "Work," Kyle said. The break had started the day before, and half of Yale was now somewhere in southern Florida. "Come on. Your last spring break and you're not headed for the beach?" "Nope. I'll be in New York next week looking for an apartment." Benny looked surprised and said, "We can help." "We've had this conversation, Benny. I don't need your help." Both took enormous bites and chewed in silence. Finally, Kyle asked, "Any news on the lawsuit?" A quick, dismissive nod. "Nothing." "Has it been filed yet?" Kyle asked. "Why can't you tell me about it?" Benny cleared his throat and sipped his water. "Next week. Let's meet next week when you're in New York, and I'll walk you through the lawsuit." "Can't wait." Another hefty bite, and they chewed for a while. "When do you take the bar exam?" Benny asked. "July." "Where?" "New York. Somewhere in Manhattan.
It's not something I'm looking forward to.
You'll do fine. When do you get the results?
Benny knew the dates and places the exam was given in New York. He knew when the results were posted online. He knew what happened to young associates if they flunked the bar. He knew everything.
Early November. Did you go to law school?
A smile, almost a chuckle.
Oh, no. I've always tried to avoid lawyers. Sometimes, though, well, that's what the job requires.
Kyle listened carefully for the accent. It tended to come and go. He thought of the Israelis and their talent for languages, especially among the Mossad and the military. Not for the first time. He wondered whom he would be spying for and against.
They met 5 days later at the Ritz-Carlton in Lower Manhattan. Kyle asked Benny if he had an office in the city, or whether he did all of his work in hotel suites. There was no response.
Before the meeting, Kyle had looked at 4 apartments, all in Soho and Tribeca. The cheapest was $4,200 a month for an 800-square-foot walk-up, and the most expensive was $6,500 a month for 1,000 square feet in a renovated warehouse. Whatever the rent, Kyle would be handling it himself because he did not want a roommate. His life would be complicated enough without the strains of living with someone else. And besides, Benny did not like the idea of a roommate. Benny and company had followed Kyle and the broker around Lower Manhattan and knew precisely where the apartments were located. By the time Kyle arrived at the hotel, operatives were calling the same realtor, inquiring about the apartments and making plans to visit them. Kyle would indeed live where he chose, but the place would be infested by the time he moved in. Benny had some thick files on the small table in the suite. "The lawsuit was filed last Friday," he began, "in federal court here in Manhattan. The plaintiff is a company called Trilon Aeronautics. The defendant is a company called Barton Dynamics." Kyle absorbed this with no expression. His file on the case and the litigants now comprised 3 4-inch spiral notebooks, over 2,000 pages, and was growing by the day. He was sure he didn't know as much as his pal Benny here, but he already knew a hell of a lot. And Benny knew he knew. From his comfortable office on Broad Street, Benny and his tech guys kept close tabs on Kyle's laptop and his desk computer in his office at the Law Journal. They monitored nonstop. And when Kyle opened his laptop in his apartment to send a note to a professor, Benny knew it. When he was working and editing a case note, Benny knew it. And when he was monitoring the court filings in New York and digging through the dirt on Trilon and Barton, Benny knew it. "Sit there and play dumb, son. I'll play along, too. You're smart as hell, but you're too stupid to realize you're in way over your head." Chapter 11. As springtime reluctantly arrived in New England, the campus came to life and shook off the lingering chill and gloom of winter. Plants bloomed, the grass showed some color, and as the days grew longer, the students found more reasons to stay outside. Frisbees flew by the hundreds. Long lunches and even picnics materialized when the sun was out. Professors became lazier. Classes grew shorter. For his last semester on campus, Kyle chose to ignore the festivities. He kept himself in his office, working feverishly to finish the details for the June edition of the Yale Law Journal. It would be his last, and he wanted it to be his best. Work provided the perfect excuse to ignore virtually everyone else. Olivia finally got fed up, and they parted amicably. His friends, all of them third-year students and about to graduate, fell into 2 groups. The first concentrated on drinking and partying and trying to savor every last moment of life on campus before being evicted and sent into the real world. The second group was already thinking about their careers, studying for the bar exam, and looking for apartments in large cities. Kyle found it easy to avoid both. On May 1st, he sent a letter to Joey Bernardo that read, "Dear Joey, I graduate from law school on May 25th. Any chance you could be here? Alan can't do it, and I'm afraid to ask Baxter. It would be great fun to hang out for a couple of days. No girlfriend, please. Correspond by regular mail at this address. No emails, no phones. I'll explain later. Best, Kyle."
The letter was handwritten and mailed from the Law Journal office. A week later, the reply arrived.
Hey, Kyle, what's with the snail mail? Your handwriting really sucks, but it's probably better than mine. I'll be there for graduation. Should be fun. What the hell is so secretive that we can't talk on the phone or use email? Are you cracking up? Baxter is. He's gone. He'll be dead in a year if we don't do something. Oh, well, my hand is aching and I feel like such an old fart writing with ink. Can't wait to get your next sweet little note. Love, Joey.
Kyle's reply was longer and filled with details. Joey's response was just as sarcastic and filled with even more questions. Kyle threw it away as soon as he read it. They swapped letters once more, and the weekend was planned. Patty McAvoy could not be coaxed from her loft for her son's graduation. Not that any real effort was made. Indeed, both John McAvoy and Kyle were pleased with her decision to stay at home, because her presence at Yale would complicate things. She had skipped the diploma service at Duquesne 3 years earlier, just as she had skipped the commencements for both of her daughters. In short, Patty didn't do graduations, regardless of how important they might be. She had managed to attend both daughters' weddings, but had been unable to take part in the planning of either. John simply wrote the checks, and somehow the family survived both ordeals. Joey Bernardo arrived in New Haven Saturday afternoon, the day before the law school's ceremonies, and as directed by the written word carried by the U.S. Postal Service, he proceeded to a dark and cavernous pizza parlor called Santo's, a mile from campus. At precisely 3 p.m. on Saturday, May 24th, he slid into a booth in the far right corner of Santo's and began to wait. He was amused and quite curious, and he was still wondering if his friend was losing his mind. 1 minute later, Kyle appeared from the back and sat across from him. They shook hands, then Kyle glanced at the front door, far away and to the right. The restaurant was almost empty, and Bruce Springsteen was rocking through the sound system. "Start talking," Joey said, now only slightly amused. "I'm being followed."
"You're cracking up. The pressure is getting to you."
"Shut up and listen." A teenage waitress paused at the table just long enough to see if they wanted anything. Both asked for Diet Colas, and Kyle ordered a large pepperoni pizza.
"Wasn't really that hungry," Joey said when she was gone.
"We're in a pizza place, so we need to order a pizza. Otherwise, we'll look suspicious." In a few minutes, a thug wearing faded jeans, a dark green rugby shirt, and a khaki golf cap will walk through the door, completely ignore us, and probably go to the bar. He'll hang around for less than 10 minutes, then he'll leave. Though he'll never look at us, he'll see everything. When you leave, either he or one of his teammates will follow you and check your license plates, and within minutes they'll know that I had a semi-secret meeting with my old pal, Joey Bernardo.
These guys are friends of yours?
No. They are professional operatives, but because I'm just me and not some highly trained thug myself, they're assuming that I have no clue that they're following me.
Great. That clears things up. Why, old buddy, are they following you?
It's a very long story.
You're not drinking again, are you? Not back on the smack?
I never did smack, and you know it. No, I'm not drinking, and I'm not losing my marbles. I'm dead serious. And I need your help.
You need a shrink, Kyle. You're spooky, man. There's a glow in your eyes.
The door opened, and the thug walked in. He was dressed precisely as Kyle had said, but with the addition of a pair of round, tortoise-shell eyeglasses.
Don't stare,
Kyle whispered as Joey's jaw dropped. The Diet Colas arrived, and they took a drink. The thug went to the bar, ordered a draft beer, and from his stool could see their table in the long mirrors behind the racks of booze, but he could not possibly hear what they were saying.
He just put on the eyeglasses,
Kyle said with a large smile as if they were telling jokes.
Sunglasses would be too conspicuous in here.
He added the big round ones so he can look around and not get caught.
Please smile. Please laugh. We're just two old chums reminiscing here. Nothing serious.
Joey was flabbergasted and could manage neither a smile nor a laugh. So Kyle erupted in a loud cackle, then pulled off a slice of thin pizza as soon as it arrived. He was animated and smiling, and with his mouth full, he said,
"Eat, Joey, and smile, and please utter a few words."
What have you done? Is that guy a cop or something?
Or something. I've done nothing wrong, but it's still a complicated story. You're involved in it.
Let's talk about the pirates.
The pirates are in last place, and they'll be in last place come September. Pick another subject or another team.
Joey finally took a slice and bit off half of it.
I need a beer. I can't eat pizza without a beer.
Kyle flagged down the lazy little waitress and ordered one beer.
There was a large screen in one corner. ESPN was running baseball highlights. For a few minutes, they ate pizza and watched the footage. The guy in the rugby shirt was working on a 12-ounce draft, and after about 10 minutes, it was gone. He paid in cash and left. When the door closed behind him, Joey said,
"What the hell is going on?"
"That's a conversation the two of us must have, but not here. It'll take an hour or two, and then the first conversation will lead to another and another. If we do it here this weekend, we'll get caught. The bad guys are watching, and if they see us engaged in serious talk, they'll know. It's important for us to finish the pizza, walk out the front door, and not be seen together alone until you leave town tomorrow."
"Thanks for inviting me up."
"I didn't invite you for the graduation, Joey. Sorry about that. The reason you're here is to give you this." Kyle slid across a folded sheet of paper. "Put it in your pocket, and quick." Joey grabbed it, glanced around as if assassins were moving in, and shoved it in a jeans pocket.
"What is it, Kyle?"
"Trust me, Joey, please. I'm in trouble and I need help. There's no one else but you."
"And I'm involved too?"
"Maybe. Let's finish the pizza and get out of here. Here's the plan. The 4th of July is just around the corner. You come up with this wonderful idea for a rafting trip down the New River in West Virginia. 3 days on the river, 2 nights camping out. Me and you and some of the old gang from Duquesne. A boys' weekend while we can still do it. The list there has 10 names and emails, stuff you already have. It also has the name of an outfitter in Beckley, West Virginia. I've done all the homework."
Joey nodded as if nothing made sense.
Kyle pressed on. "The purpose of the trip is to shake the surveillance. Once we're on the river and in the mountains, there's no way they can follow me. We can talk and talk and not have to worry about being watched."
"This is crazy."
"You're crazy."
"Shut up, Joey. I'm not crazy. I'm dead serious. They watch me around the clock. They listen to my phone calls and they bugged my laptop."
"And they're not cops?"
"No, they're much scarier than cops. If we spend too much time together now, they'll become suspicious and your life will get complicated. Eat some pizza."
"I'm not hungry." There was a long gap in the conversation. Kyle kept eating. Joey kept watching the ESPN highlights. Springsteen kept singing. After a few minutes, Kyle said, "Look, we need to go. I have a lot to tell you, but I can't do it now. If you'll plan the rafting trip, we can have some fun, and I'll give you the full story."
"You ever been rafting?"
"Sure. You?"
"No. I don't like the water."
"They provide life jackets. Come on, Joey, have some fun. A year from now, you'll be married, and your life will be over."
"Thanks, pal."
"It's just a boys' trip down the river. A bunch of old friends from college. Shoot the emails and put it all together. What do you say?"
"Sure, Kyle. Whatever."
"But when you email me, use the diversion."
"The diversion?"
"Yes, it's written down. In your emails to me, we're headed for the Potomac River in western Maryland. We can't give these thugs too much notice."
"What are they going to do? Follow us down the river in a speedboat?"
"No, it's just a precaution. I don't want them anywhere around me."
"This is real strange, Kyle."
"It gets stranger." Joey suddenly slid the pizza aside and leaned forward on his elbows. He glared at Kyle and said,
"I'll do it, but you gotta give me a clue."
Elaine's back, with her rape scenario.
Just as quickly as he had leaned forward, Joey shrunk back to his side of the booth and limply recoiled.
Elaine who? He'd forgotten her last name, if in fact he'd ever known it. That was 5, maybe 6 years ago, and the cops had not only closed the file, but slammed the damn thing shut. And why? Because nothing happened.
There was no rape. Intercourse, maybe, but with that girl, everything was consensual.
He had a December wedding planned with the woman of his dreams, and nothing, absolutely nothing, could screw it up. He had a career, a future, a good name. How could this nightmare be alive? With so much to say,
He managed to say nothing. He stared at Kyle, who couldn't help but feel sorry for him.
Is she awake? Joey asks.
No response from Baxter Tate. No response from the girl.
This is something we can deal with, Joey. It's frightening, but we can handle it. We need to talk, for hours, but not here, not now. Let's get away.
Sure. Whatever you say.
That night, Kyle met his father for dinner at a Greek place called the Athenian. They were joined by Joey Bernardo, who'd had a few drinks in preparation for the evening and was so mellow he was quite dull. Or maybe he was just stunned, or scared, or something else. But he was certainly preoccupied. John McAvoy downed two martinis before he touched a menu, and was soon telling war stories about old trials and old cases. Joey matched him martini for martini, and the gin thickened his tongue, but did not lighten his mood. Kyle had invited him because he did not want his father to launch into a last-ditch effort to persuade him to resist the evils of corporate law and do something productive with his life. But after the second martini, and with Joey barely coherent, John McAvoy made such an effort. Kyle chose not to argue. He ate garlic crackers and hummus and listened. Red wine arrived, and his father told another story about representing some poor soul with a good case but no money, and of course he won, as is true with the vast majority of lawyers' tales. John McAvoy was the hero of all his stories. The poor were saved. The weak were protected. Kyle almost missed his mother. Late that night, long after dinner, Kyle walked the Yale campus for the last time as a student. He was stunned at the speed at which the last 3 years had gone by, yet he was also tired of law school. He was tired of lectures and classrooms and exams and the meager existence on a student's budget. At 25, he was now a fully grown man, nicely educated and all in one piece with no bad habits, no permanent damage. At this point, the future should hold great promise and excitement. Instead, he felt nothing but fear and apprehension. 7 years of school, great success as a student, and it was all coming down to this, the miserable life of an unwilling spy.
Chapter 12. Of the two apartments Kyle was considering, Benny preferred the one in the old meatpacking district, near the Ganzevoort Hotel, in a building that was 120 years old and had been built for the sole purpose of slaughtering hogs and cows. But the carnage was now history, and the developer had done a splendid job of gutting the place and renovating it into a collection of boutiques on the first floor, hip offices on the second, and modern apartments from there upward. Benny cared nothing about being hip or modern, and could not have cared less about the location. What impressed him was the fact that the apartment directly above 5D was also available as a sublet. Benny grabbed it, 6D, at $5,200 a month for 6 months. Then he waited for Kyle to lease 5D. Kyle, though, was leaning toward a second-story walk-up on Beekman Street, near City Hall and the Brooklyn Bridge. It was smaller and cheaper at $3,800, still an obscene amount for the square footage. In New Haven, Kyle had been splitting $1,000 a month for a dump, but one that was three times as large as anything he'd seen in Manhattan. Scully and Pershing had paid him a signing bonus of $25,000, and he was thinking of using it to secure a nice apartment early in the summer when more were available. He would lock himself away in his new digs, study nonstop for 6 weeks, and take the New York bar exam in late July. When it became obvious to Benny that Kyle was ready to lease the Beekman apartment, he arranged for one of his operatives to suddenly appear, badger the real estate agent, and offer more money. It worked, and Kyle was headed for the meatpacking district. When he verbally agreed to take 5D for $5,100 a month for a year, beginning on July 15th, Benny dispatched a team of technicians to decorate the place 2 weeks before Kyle was scheduled to move in. Listening devices were planted in the walls of every room. The telephone and internet wires were tapped and wired to receivers and computers located directly above in 6D. Four hidden cameras were installed, one each in the den, the kitchen, and the two bedrooms. Each could be withdrawn immediately in the event Kyle or someone else started poking around. They, too, were connected to computers in 6D, so Benny and his boys could watch Kyle do everything except shower, shave, brush his teeth, and use the toilet.
Some things should be kept private.
On June 2nd, Kyle loaded everything he owned into his Jeep Cherokee and left Yale and New Haven. For a few miles, he went through the usual nostalgia of saying goodbye to his student days, but by the time he passed through Bridgeport, he was thinking about the bar exam and what was waiting beyond it. He drove to Manhattan, where he planned to spend a few days with friends, then move into his apartment on the 15th. He had yet to sign a lease, and the real estate agent was becoming irritated. He was ignoring her phone calls. As scheduled, on June 3rd, he took a cab to the Peninsula Hotel in Midtown and found Benny Wright in a 10th-floor suite. His handler was dressed in customary drab attire, dark suit, white shirt, boring tie, black shoes. But on June 3rd, he had an additional article or two. His suit coat was off, and Benny had strapped around his shirt a shiny black leather holster with a 9mm Beretta snug just below his left armpit. A quick move with the right hand, and the pistol was in play. Kyle ran through all the sarcastic remarks he might make in the presence of such weaponry, but decided at the last second to simply ignore it. It was obvious that Benny wanted his Beretta to be noticed, maybe even mentioned. Just ignore it. Kyle sat as he always sat with Benny, right ankle on his left knee, arms folded across his chest, wearing a look of complete contempt. "Congratulations on your graduation," Benny said, sipping coffee from a paper cup and standing by the window that overlooked Fifth Avenue. "Did things go well?"
"You were there, you asshole. Your boys watched me and Joey eat a pizza. You know what my father had for dinner and how many martinis he knocked back. You saw Joey stagger out of the Greek place drunk as a skunk.
When they took my photo in cap and gown, your goons were probably snapping away, too."
"Swell," Kyle said. "That's great. Have you found an apartment?"
"I think so."
"Where?"
"Why do you care? I thought we agreed that you would stay away from me."
"Just trying to be polite, Kyle, that's all."
"Why? It really pisses me off when we get together and you start this happy horseshit like we're a couple of old pals. I'm not here because I want to be. I'm not chit-chatting with you because I choose to. I'd rather be anywhere else in the world right now. I'm here because you're blackmailing me. I despise you, okay? Don't ever forget that. And stop trying to be polite. It goes against your personality."
"Oh, I can be a prick."
"You are a prick."
Benny sipped his coffee and kept smiling. "Well, moving right along. May I ask when you take the bar exam?"
"No, because you know precisely when I take the bar exam. What am I here for, Benny? What's the purpose of this meeting?"
"Just a friendly hello. Welcome to New York.
Congrats on finishing law school. How's the family? That kind of stuff."
"I'm touched."
Benny set down his coffee cup and picked up a thick notebook. He handed it to Kyle. "These are the latest filings in the Trilon-Barton lawsuit. Motion to dismiss, supporting affidavits, supporting exhibits, briefs in support of, and briefs in opposition to. Order overruling said motion. Answer filed by the defendant, Barton, and so on. As you know, the file is sealed, so what you're holding there is unauthorized."
"How'd you get it?" Kyle asked.
Benny responded with the same silly smirk he always gave when Kyle asked a question that could not be answered. "When you're not studying for the bar exam, you can bone up on the lawsuit." "A question. It seems to me that it's a long shot for Scully and Pershing to assign me to the litigation section that happens to be handling this case, and it's even more of a stretch to believe they would allow a green associate to get anywhere near it. I'm sure you've thought about this."
"And the question is?
What happens if I'm nowhere near this case?"
"Your class will have about 100 rookie associates, same as last year and the year before. Roughly 10% will be assigned to litigation. The others will go into everything else. Mergers, acquisitions, tax, antitrust, transactions, securities, finance, estates, and all the other wonderful services the firm provides. You'll be the star of the litigation rookies because you're the brightest and you'll work 18 hours a day, 7 days a week, and you'll suck up and kiss ass and backstab and do all the right things it takes to succeed in a big law firm. You'll want to work on this case, you'll demand it, and because it's the biggest lawsuit in the firm, you'll eventually be assigned to it."
"Sorry I asked."
"And while you're worming your way onto this case,
you'll be providing us with other valuable information.
Like what?
It's too early to discuss. Right now, you need to concentrate on the bar exam.
Bless you. I hadn't thought about it.
They sniped for another 10 minutes. Then Kyle left in a huff, as usual. From the backseat of a taxi, he called the realtor and said he'd changed his mind about living in the meatpacking district. The realtor was upset, but managed to keep her cool. Kyle had signed nothing, and she had no legal ammo to launch. He promised to give her a call in a few days, and they would resume their search for something smaller and cheaper. Kyle moved his junk into a spare room in the Soho apartment of Charles and Charles, two Yale law grads who'd finished a year earlier and were now working for different mega firms. They had played lacrosse at Hopkins, and were probably a couple, though they'd kept things quiet, at least at Yale. Kyle had no interest in their relationship. He needed a bed for a while and a place to store his possessions. And he needed to keep Benny honest, if that was possible. The Charleses offered them their junk room for free, but Kyle insisted on paying $200 a week. The apartment would be a great place to study because the Charleses were seldom there. Both were being thrashed by 100-hour work weeks. When it became clear that Benny's operation had just been stiffed for 6 months' rent at $5,200 per for apartment 6D in the slaughterhouse, plus the costly decoration of 5D below it, plus $4,100 a month for a year for the apartment on Beekman, Benny fumed, but did not panic. The wasted money was not a factor. What bothered him was the unpredictability of it. For the past 4 months, Kyle had done little to surprise them. The surveillance had been effortless. The trip to Pittsburgh in February had been dissected and no longer concerned them. But now Kyle was in the city, where watching him was more challenging. A civilian subject is usually easy because of predictable thoughts and patterns. Why would he try to shake surveillance if he didn't know it was there? But how much did Kyle know or suspect? How predictable was he? Benny licked his wounds for an hour, then began planning his next project. Research on Charles and Charles, and a quick inspection of their apartment. The second detoxification of Baxter Tate began with a knock on his front door, then another. He had not answered his cell phone. He had been driven home by a cab at 4 a.m. from a trendy nightclub in Beverly Hills. The driver helped him into his condo. After the fourth knock, the door was quietly opened with no effort because Baxter hadn't bothered to lock it. The two men, specialists in retrieving wayward family members with addiction problems, found Baxter on his bed, still dressed in last night's getup. White linen shirt stained with some strain of liquor, black linen Xenia sport coat, bleached designer jeans, Bregano loafers, no socks, over his very tanned ankles. He was comatose, breathing heavy but not snoring. Still alive, but not for long, not at the rate he was going. They quickly searched the bedroom and adjoining bathroom for weapons. Both men were armed, but their handguns were hidden under their jackets. Then they radioed to a waiting car, and another man entered the condo. He was Baxter's uncle, a man named Walter Tate. Uncle Wally, brother to Baxter's father, the only one of five siblings who had accomplished anything in life. The family banking fortune was now 3 generations old and declining at a steady but not alarming rate. The last time Walter had seen his nephew, he was in a lawyer's office in Pittsburgh, cleaning up after another drunk driving episode. Because his four siblings were unable to make even the most basic decisions in life, Walter had long since assumed the role of the family boss. He watched the investments, met with the lawyers, handled the press when necessary, and reluctantly intervened when one of his nieces or nephews flamed out. His own son had been killed hang gliding. This was his second intervention with Baxter, and it would be the last. The first had been 2 years earlier, also in L.A., and they had shipped the boy off to a ranch in Montana, where he sobered up, rode horses, made new friends, saw the light. Sobriety lasted all of 2 weeks after he returned to his worthless career in Hollywood. Walter's limit was 2 rehabs. After that, they could kill themselves for all he cared. Baxter had been dead to the world for about 9 hours when Uncle Wally shook his leg long enough and hard enough to rouse him from his drunkenness. The sight of 3 strange men standing by his bed startled him. He backed away from them, scrambling to the other end of the bed. Then he recognized Uncle Wally. He'd lost some hair, put on a few pounds. How long had it been? The family never got together. In fact, the family strove mightily to avoid one another. Baxter rubbed his eyes, then his temples. A skull-cracking headache arrived suddenly. He looked at Uncle Wally, then at the two strangers.
Well, well, he said. How's Aunt Rochelle?
Rochelle had been the first of Walter's wives, but she was the only one Baxter ever remembered. She had terrified him as a child, and he would always despise her.
She died last year, Walter said. That's just awful. What brings you to L.A.?
He kicked off his loafers and wrapped his arms around a pillow. It was now obvious where this was going.
We're taking a trip, Baxter, the four of us. We're going to check you into another clinic, sober you up, then see if they can put you back together.
So this is an intervention?
Yes.
Groovy. Happens all the time out here. It's a miracle a single movie ever gets made with all the damned intervening that goes on in Hollywood. Everybody's always getting asked to help with an intervention.
I mean, look, you're not going to believe this, but 2 months ago, I took part in an intervention. A link, that's what I was called, but I guess you guys know all about that. Can you imagine? I'm sitting in a hotel room with these other links, some I know, some I don't, and poor Jimmy walks in, beer in hand, and gets absolutely ambushed. His brother sits him down. Then we go around the room and tell the poor boy what a miserable piece of shit he is. Made him cry. But then, they always cry, don't they? I cried, didn't I? Now I remember. Oh, you should have heard me lecturing Jimmy about the evils of vodka and cocaine. If he hadn't been crying so hard, he would have come after me. Could I have a glass of water?
Who are you?
They're with me. Uncle Wally said. I figured.
One of the specialists handed Baxter a bottle of water. He drained it in one long, noisy slurp, with water splashing down his chin.
Got any painkillers? He said desperately.
They handed over some pills and another bottle of water. When he had consumed it all, he said,
Where are we going this time?
Nevada. There's a clinic near Reno, in the mountains. Spectacular country.
It's not a dude ranch, is it? I can't take another 30 days on a horse. My ass is still raw from the last detox.
Uncle Wally was still standing at the foot of the bed. He had not moved a step.
No horses this time. It's a different kind of place.
Oh, really? I hear they're all the same. Folks here are always talking about their latest rehab, always comparing notes.
Great way to pick up girls in a bar.
He spoke with his eyes closed tightly as the pain rippled through his head.
No, this is different.
How so?
It's a bit tougher, and you'll be there longer.
Do tell. How long?
As long as it takes.
Can I just promise to stop drinking right now and skip the whole damn thing?
No.
And I'm assuming that since you're here and since you're the big chief of this sorry little tribe, my participation is not exactly voluntary.
Right.
Because if I say go to hell, get out of my house, I'm calling the police because the three of you broke in, and that there's no way I'm taking a trip with you. If I say all that, then you'll simply bring up the trust funds, right?
Right.
The nausea hit like lightning. Baxter bolted from the bed, shedding his sport coat as he stumbled through the door to the bathroom. The vomiting was loud and long and mixed with waves of profanities. He washed his face, looked at his swollen red eyes in the mirror, and admitted that a few days of sobriety was not a bad idea, but he couldn't imagine a whole lifetime with no booze and no drugs. The trust funds had been established by a great-grandfather who had no idea what he was doing. In the days before private jets and luxury yachts and cocaine and countless other ways to burn the family fortune, the prudent thing to do was to preserve the money for future generations. But Baxter's grandfather had seen the warning signs. He hired the lawyers and changed the trusts so that a board of advisors could exercise a measure of discretion. Some of the money arrived each month and allowed Baxter to survive quite comfortably without working. but the serious money could be turned off like a spigot, and Uncle Wally controlled it with an iron fist. If Uncle Wally said you were going to rehab, then you were about to dry out. Baxter stood in the bathroom door, leaning on the facing, and looked at the three. They had not budged. He looked at the specialist nearest to him and said, "You guys here to break my thumbs if I put up a fight?"
"No," came the reply.
"Let's go, Baxter," Walter said.
"Do I pack?"
"No."
"Your jet?"
"Yes."
"Last time I was allowed to get hammered."
"The clinic says you can drink all you want on the ride in. The bar is stocked."
"How long's the flight?"
90 minutes.
"I'll have to drink fast."
"I'm sure you can handle that." Baxter waved his arms and looked around his bedroom.
"What about my place? The bills, the maid, the mail?"
"I'll take care of everything. Let's go." Baxter brushed his teeth, combed his hair, changed his shirt, then followed Uncle Wally and the other two outside and into a black van. They rode in silence for a few minutes, but the tension was finally broken by the sounds of Baxter crying in the rear seat.